The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Want to stop a war? It's simple. Just spend money. If you want to save a nation, spend money. Buy friends abroad. Spend money. If you want to live happily, it's going to cost money. Now we're being told that X number of hundreds of millions added to the incredible sum of about 146 billions could stave off almost certain collapse of South Vietnam. At the same time, we are seeing that the investment of over 50,000 American lives, the expenditure of $146 billion, has led inexorably, for any number of manifold reasons, to the present debacle we see experienced by the South Vietnamese people and the Cambodian people, where it appears two tottering and basically corrupt regimes of graft and vice, of chicanery, corruption, dishonesty.
All the men, all the guns, all the sacrifice, all in vain. Vietnam is gone, lost to the communists. Make no mistake about that.
And greetings, friends around the world. The long war is over, the headline said. Peace after 12 years. That's the headlines in the United States after former President Nixon announced a peace agreement had been concluded with the communist forces in Vietnam, that American troops were being brought home, and finally, that even POWs would be returned. But you know, at that time, for Americans, the president's peace announcement was a rather hollow victory, because by 1973, when that announcement was made, Vietnam had become one of the worst nightmares and tragedies in all of American history. And today, we daily are witnessing the nightmarish finish to that tragedy. And greetings, friends around the world. Stunned Americans may now reflect upon the exultant headlines following former President Nixon's announcement that a peace agreement had been concluded with the communist forces in Vietnam. They said then, years ago, the long war is over. Peace after 12 years. And then we sat glued to our television sets, remember, and we watched all of the POWs come home. We heard about the final great success. Nixon, when he got to the White House, inherited what then was called Johnson's War. And finally, it became Nixon's War to the anti-war protesters. But gradually, that war was wound down. Gradual disengagement, as the Vietnamese troops could take over the battlefield positions from American benefactors, that became the rule of the day. Skillful negotiations finally brought about the release of most POWs, and so finally, they said, quote, the long war is over. Those were the headlines. That was the way they talked in the newspapers. And though we were no longer directly involved, the war continued. Now we see the incredible nightmare of human suffering. We hear of the C-5A crash that took the lives of many unfortunate little refugees. We hear of sensational airlifts of Vietnamese orphans and waifs, many of them the children of American servicemen. We hear of the cries abroad of a nation being butchered and ravished and torn asunder, estimates varying from 45% to 75% of the nation gone to the North Vietnamese and the communist enemy, estimates varying from $1 to $2 billion worth of American equipment given over into the hands of the enemy. We see the headlines of recent
politics days of politics. How it was during the Johnson administration, a leading weekly news magazine editorializing on Mr. Johnson's chances in the upcoming election viewed the president's chances from the perspective of the violent anti-war demonstrations, the civil rights movement, the arms race, pollution, and most especially, the Vietnam War. And as that November drew ominously nearer, the magazine blandly prophesied that the Vietnam War would almost certainly be brought to some sort of conclusion. The reason? Well, they said that Mr. Johnson would most certainly not dare face the voters in the upcoming election with a war on his hands. I remember responding rather violently to that on the program at the time. That's quite an indictment, isn't it? I just can't believe that that could be true. Yet it was somehow lost in the normal, repetitious analyses by the media that always surround some impending presidential election. I don't think the people who wrote that statement in the magazine knew what they said, but in effect they were saying that presidents can start wars, that they can protract wars, that they can halt wars through various means that are commonly at their disposal if the stakes are high enough. In other words, an election. That if a president, quote, has a war on his hands, there's an election coming, well, I better get rid of the war. That's exactly what they were saying in his magazine. The kind of politics that puts occupying an office, winning an election, ahead of some of the incredible agonies of the human race is inconceivable to me. If you want to find out why, to me, politics stink and will always stink.
Did you know that for a time there, during the Truman administration, after World War II, and then when Ike came in, we were still supporting Ho Chi Minh? Did you know that for a time, Japanese troops were even given arms under British occupying authorities and Americans to keep the peace in that country of Vietnam? Now, you have to go clear back to the ouster of the French from North Vietnam and Dien Bien Phu and learn a few lessons from that. It's too long to discuss on one program. It would take you probably a month of Sundays to come to understand the incredible history of that area. But I'm going to make a statement. I'll probably get some hate mail over. Do you know that in the long run, the United States would have been better off to have continued supporting Ho Chi Minh? Isn't that an incredible statement for me to make? I think history will finally prove that it is true. That's what we started doing. But the pragmatists who entered government back during the Truman administration and who were inherited largely by Eisenhower, who began to talk about containment, encirclement, the domino theory, who began to introduce a new kind of warfare to Americans that we had never understood and never tried to fight before when America had no legions. Now, if you're going to fight the battles of legions, you'd better have legionnaires. If you've decided to become an empire and the world's policeman, and you decide to use limited force for limited objectives in faraway countries as an extension of national or a foreign policy, then you had better have professional mercenaries who are willing to fight and to die, because that's what troops are all about. If a person wears the uniform of his country, whether for pay or whether for patriotism, he knows that a soldier is expected to fight, and if necessary, to die. That's what a professional army is all about. But the United States didn't have any legions. We just had the proverbial American young boy, who increasingly, as our involvement in Vietnam became more and more protracted and more unpopular at home, dividing the entirety of Congress, the American people, creating a generation gap, a credibility gap, sending our campuses into riot and turmoil, so that at one time in late 1960s there were more Americans facing other Americans over loaded guns than there were Americans facing the enemy on Vietnamese battlefields. We have proved in wars of the past that American soldiers can fight and fight well if they are fighting all stops out to win. If you want to talk about lofty idealism such as preserving democracy, that's fine, but that's not really why the troops fight when troops go to ground. It's to preserve their own lives. It's either him or me. It's maybe for mom or for girlfriend or for home and family. It's fighting to survive. It's fighting to win. It's fighting for a lot of rather obscure reasons, none of which are so lofty and idealized as to make democracy safe for the world. Not when the bullets start flying, it's not. It's fighting because if you don't kill him, he will kill you. But Americans have never been able to understand fighting as an extension of foreign policy, leaning on an enemy. By committing troops piecemeal to battle in order to bring that enemy to a conference table. We should have learned that lesson in Korea, but we did not. Did you know that some of the bloodiest of all the battles in Korea were fought during the days of the peace talks at Panmunjom? Bloody Ridge, Bunker Hill, Pork Chop Hill, Heartbreak Ridge, those were battles playing King of the Mountain. Men committed piecemeal to battle as needed in order to win a hill when they knew in their hearts the very next day the commanders might tell them for purely political reasons
to withdraw from that hill in order to tidy up the lines and make them meet along the border with the enemy. And so in Korea we found with amazement Americans defecting to the enemy, and when they were captured even deciding not to return to their native land but to go to live in communist China. We were shocked. We couldn't believe that Americans who had been captured in battle would actually turn on their own comrades in arms, but they did. And then in Vietnam we were further shocked. We labored through all of the agony of the Cali trial. We labored through the living room war where we had to see the shattered bodies and the explosions and the dismembered people. We had to see murder and brutality along with the evening meal in the television set, which is why Vietnam became known as the living room war. It'll probably be known in history as the war that was begun by the government and ended by the people. And the public mood moved from one of disillusionment to absolute hatred of that war. We came to loathe that war before our involvement in it was over. And in Vietnam, once again, we saw the spectacle of troops being committed piecemeal to battle, to lean on an enemy as an extension of policy. There was no front. There was no rear. There was no home front. There were no patriotic songs, no great heroes, no inspiring great war stories. Those who wore the flag were challenged by those who burnt it. The youth and the elderly fought, the long hair and the hard hat fought, the student fought the police. And it was a trial for everybody. And finally, Vietnam had revived dormant yearnings for isolation from foreign troubles and the problems of other countries. It had destroyed America's feelings that we possessed the value or political ideology that gave us some claim to rightness or righteousness to solve the world's problems. Our innocency, after all, would have been hard to justify with the almost daily pictures of long strings of bombs cascading down upon helpless civilians in the landscape of North Vietnam from the bomb bays of B-52s, wouldn't it? Vietnam split the leaders of our nation into two polarized groups, hawks and doves. It also shattered a long tradition of bipartisan support for a president's foreign policy. Vietnam made military conscription and military establishment in general so unpopular that both parties began calling for an all-volunteer army. Vietnam drained away billions upon billions of dollars and energy from giant domestic projects and problems that were needed, and it raised consumer prices, and it raised workers' wages since it was financed by deficit spending. And the Vietnam War is at the direct root and cause of today's incredible stagflation. The government printing press that was grinding out the tons and tons of crisp new 20s and 100s to finance the billions that were poured into the Vietnamese War, the defense industry, and all related industries that supported it, that caused runaway inflation. It's at the root cause of America's economic sickness of today was the deficit spending required to finance the Vietnam War. And economists know that. It also caused the greatest dissent in all of our history, igniting riots and demonstrations on campuses, sending draft dodgers to Canada and Sweden. It drove President Johnson from the White House. It was called Johnson's War. Mr. Nixon came in. It was called Nixon's War. He at least, although I doubt very much with people's unbelievable and incredible self-righteous misjudgment of today, will remember anything of Mr. Nixon kindly, because suddenly he has become the whipping boy for practically every evil story and joke you can imagine on the face of the earth, and nothing that was right or good or well done about his administration is even being mentioned in the media these days. So I'll mention one thing. No matter the irony of today, the troops did come home finally, and it was during the Nixon administration, and he tried to do it. And no matter the unbelievable death throes of a nation today, at least those American POWs are not being slaughtered over there as the troops advance, and Americans are not dying in Vietnam today, even though tens and hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese are, which is sick all by itself. But Vietnam also produced a counterculture in the United States that accelerated the growth of a counterculture that simply turned off on America, and instead turned on to rock concerts, to drugs, to free love, to alienation, to violence. It reduced meaningful debate into a shouting match between those who wanted to wrap themselves in the flag and patriotism and those who wanted to burn it. It produced confrontation
along every strain in contemporary America, between races, between classes, between generations. It divided Americans against Americans as had never happened since the Civil War, to the point the fabric of society almost tore completely apart, and some could not help but draw the analogy of the Civil War in the very worst and dark days of the latter part of the 1960s. It eroded the authority and trustability of our major institutions. Not just government and military alone, but business, universities, religion, and even science, believe it or not, became suspect. And of course now, other major institutions such as the CIA and the FBI, by their own admission, have joined the long and seemingly endless line of major institutions of U.S. government and policy that stand in ignominy, being virtually unclothed in public and embarrassed by some of the most shameful admissions, which is openly practiced by every government in the world and has been all down through history, but on our own self-righteous name-calling and blame-placing urge of today, we choose in our false claim to righteousness to decry that which is done by cloak-and-dagger U.S. agents as being obscene and immoral, and somehow fail to indict other countries who have been doing it all the way down through history. No, two wrongs do not make a right. I don't believe that. I'm talking for the moment from the point of view of government in the hands of man, and the irrationalities and the lack of proper perspective and priority in the minds of so many people. Vietnam eroded the confidence the American people had in themselves, in their leaders, and in their country. Did we really help Vietnam? Was it a peace with honor after all? The answer in today's news has got to be no. No, we maybe forestalled it. Maybe we put it off. Maybe it's going to be worse now than it would have been if we had never been involved in the first place. At least some reporters have asked government officials lately, look, we're pushing the policy of detente with the Soviet Union, right? Answer is yes. We're pushing detente with communist China, right? The answer is yes. Beginning cultural exchanges. We'd like to warm it up even more. We have seen the unbelievable spectacle of the nationalist Chinese out of the United Nations and the communist Chinese in. Why then, some of them want to know of government officials, do we not just allow the same natural attrition to occur in Southeast Asia and then seek for détente and later entente with new regimes, exactly as we are doing in other notable parts of the world? Well, maybe that would be pondered at some later date. But as we witness that painful series of events, all the way down through the agony of Vietnam, where some of the names like Ben Hoa and Cam Ranh Bay and Saigon and Da Nang and Pleiku province and the demilitarized zone became American household words, you're tempted to say, in the backdrop of what is happening right now today, to borrow a phrase from Sir Winston Churchill's famous World War II statement, never had so many paid so much for so little. We lost more lives in Vietnam than we did in Korea, and both were big wars. You know, many American battlefield commanders, when rehearsing their troops before going into battle in Vietnam, by eyewitness accounts, have said, I don't know why I'm here. You don't know why you're here. But since we're both here, we might as well do the best job we can and do our best to stay alive. That was about the best that you could say for the speeches that were made before they asked troops to go out to try to find an enemy that looked just like the fellow fighting along at their side. And the enemy could be anywhere in the bars of Saigon, or the rice paddies, or the streets of the villages, or they could be in the jungle, virtually impenetrable, and even able to absorb the entirety of the punishment of the bombing attacks that actually superseded, in terms of explosives expended, the entire effort of the United States during World War II. Not only then did this become our longest war in all of history, but it cost us 56,000 dead and 140 billion plus. And you have to ask today, as you read your headlines, What in the world do we have to show for it all? I don't know whether I can answer that question. I think maybe the collective experts of government who have been the advisors of presidents and leaders in the Pentagon should have to answer that question to the American people, but more importantly, to the Vietnamese people. I think it's time to take time out to say a prayer for a helpless people being butchered right before our startled eyes, and to wonder what in the world is going to happen next.
Our major institutions, not just government or military, but even business, the universities, religion, and science. Even the CIA did not emerge from Vietnam unscathed, as bitter accusations abounded that the CIA had spied on war protesters. Vietnam typified a growing feeling that gripped Americans everywhere. Problems seemed insoluble. Every effort to alleviate problems only intensified them. There were no easy answers. Somehow, America had lost its way in everything. Vietnam was not the cause of these problems, but it was catalytic. It was the catalyst that inflamed them. Americans were confused, frustrated, and divided at home and abroad because America had no great unified national sense of purpose or values. Everyone seemed to be doing his own thing. Abroad, American prestige sank to new lows as the vaunted U.S. military might was unable to win a decisive victory after years of fighting. In the beginning of the war, Americans thought we had a purpose for fighting in Vietnam. We were going to honor our commitments. We had to stop communist aggression on a distant shore, to aid a helpless country, to ensure that a free people could stay free, to ensure the right of a free people of self-determination, to choose their own government and their own way of life. In the middle of that war, we weren't sure why we were fighting. And at the end of it, almost everyone felt it had been a colossal mistake from the very beginning. We witnessed a painful series of events, My Lai massacres, an innocent napalm child running naked and screaming down a highway. All the men, all the guns, all the sacrifice, all in vain.